You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
This morning, as another installment in our Favorite Things series, I'd like to introduce you to a friend of mine. He's been a part of my life for over 30 years. He's not a friend in the ordinary sense of the world. I've never had a conversation with him. I've never shared a meal with him. We've never exchanged letters. Still, there are some people whose work or words or music or art get weaved so much into the fabric of one's life that they become almost like friends. For me, one of those longtime friends is the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. I want to tell you why Arvo Pärt and his music has become so important to my life. I want to relate this not simply because I find his music beautiful, but because I think both he and his music have taught me much about prayer, silence, suffering, joy, grace, love, and the unique and often paradoxical ways that God has brought resurrection out of seasons in my life that have felt barren and dead. I first encountered him in the autumn of 1991. Darlene and I were newly married. We had recently moved to Vancouver, British Columbia, the first time I'd ever lived outside of Saskatchewan in my life. I had just begun graduate studies at Regent College. A few months into my first term, I wandered into the college bookstore. To be honest, I was feeling overwhelmed and ill-prepared, both intellectually and spiritually, for theological studies. I remember feeling small and inadequate. And then, unexpectedly, I heard this over the bookstore speakers. I'd never heard this music before. The music was simple. Just two instruments, a violin and a piano. And it seemed like they were engaged in a conversation. The violin would offer a phrase. The piano would respond with a phrase. There would be a pause. And then the conversation would continue, like a warm conversation between two friends. The music felt pure and innocent and intimate. Nothing about it felt rushed or complicated. The music had nothing to prove, so to speak. There was an unguarded vulnerability to the music, and I stood there, transfixed, and listened to it for over 10 minutes. The piece was Spiegel im Spiegel by Arvo Pärt, of course. Translated from the German to English, it is Mirror in the Mirror. In that moment, feeling overwhelmed and inadequate, I encountered something that spoke to my heart as if to say, be still, be. Listen, there's more to receive than what you're hearing at the present. And I've been listening to this music ever since. Arvo Pärt was born in Estonia in 1935, shortly before his country was invaded by Nazi Germany and then, after World War II, absorbed into the Soviet Union. His childhood and early adult life unfolded under the shadow of military violence, ideological oppression, exile, and uncertainty. His childhood was difficult, but music for the young Arvo served as a consolation. As a boy, every Friday afternoon, a concert played over the loudspeakers in his local town square. And to avoid being teased by other kids for standing under the speakers, he would instead ride his bicycle around the square, listening to the concert while on two wheels. Imagine that. This child, pedaling his bike around in an Estonian town square, would one day become one of the most celebrated musicians of his generation. By his 40s, he was recognized as one of the most acclaimed composers in the Soviet Union. But something was beginning to transform his inner life. In the early 1970s, his infant Lutheran baptismal vows became a lived reality in his adult life. And this renewal dramatically changed him and his music. It was not an easy thing to do or to hide in the Soviet Union, where atheism was not simply the absence of religious belief, but an ideology woven into the fabric of the state itself. Nonetheless, Pärt began writing music rooted in scripture and nourished by Christian liturgy. Eventually, in 1980, He and his young family were expelled from the Soviet Union for doing so. At first, they lived in Vienna, and then Berlin, and more than a decade after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they returned to live in an independent Estonia. Today, Pärt is regarded as one of the greatest living composers in the world. But what has captured my attention since I first stood transfixed in Regent's Bookstore is not just that he is a great composer, it's how he became the composer he became. And key to that story is silence. One of the most distinctive qualities of Pärt's music is the way that he uses silence. Not silence as a mere absence of music, nor silence in a minimalism device, but silence as the space from which music emerges. Pärt has said, quote, "Before one says something, perhaps it's better to say nothing. My music has emerged only after I've been silent for quite some time." Literally, silent. And then he says something that I find profoundly theological. He says, "For me, silent means the nothing from which God created the world." I think that's an extraordinary way to think about silence. Silence is an emptiness. Rather, silence is where God is preparing something. Paul Hillier, who has written extensively about Pärt's music, says that when we create music, we express life, but the source of music is silence. And then he offers this haunting thought. He writes, "How we live depends on our relationship with death. How we make music depends on our relationship with silence." I think that is true not only of music, I think it's also true of prayer. It may even be true of Christian discipleship. For we live in a world that's frankly just averse to silence. C.S. Lewis understood this deeply, I think. In the Screwtape Letters, letter 22, Screwtape, the senior demon correspondent, becomes almost ecstatic when he writes about the importance of noise. Screwtape exclaims, "Music and silence, how I detest them both." Noise is what keeps us from thinking clearly. Noise is what keeps us from listening openly. Noise is what keeps us from attending to the presence of God. Screwtape imagines hell filling the world with noise until, as he puts it, the melodies and silences of heaven will be shouted down. That sentiment strikes me as remarkably contemporary. We have more noise now than Lewis ever could have imagined from our devices, from the news, from advertisers. Even when we're alone, we're rarely alone with silence. And perhaps the deepest noise is not outside of us at all. Pärt makes a distinction that I find helpful. He observes that silence can be both outside and inside us. External silence may be easy to find, but the silence of the soul, the silence that remains even when there are distractions around us, is so much harder. That is the silence Pärt's music invites me to attend. It's not merely being quiet, it's listening. That's why I've come to think of Pärt's music as a kind of prayer for me. His music has taught me to listen for God. The point is not always to hear something. Sometimes the point is just to become the kind of person who can listen. There's a fascinating period in Pärt's life when this relationship between silence, faith, and music becomes especially clear. In 1968, he composed a musical piece for piano, choir, and symphony called Credo. The Latin title translates into English simply as "I Believe," and the piece is in many ways a confession of faith. And I'll just say this, it's probably not a great place to start with Pärt's music. It's quite chaotic, and I'm going to explain that in a moment, but I know my wife doesn't like it a whole lot when I play this music at home. She finds it actually distracting. But this was a big start for him, and it's an important moment, and it combines a line from the Christian creed, "Credo in Jesum Christum," "I believe in Jesus Christ," and it combines that in a collage of texts with Jesus' words from Matthew 5. "You've heard it that was said, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evil person." Credo is also a musical collage. Near the beginning is an excerpt from Johann Sebastian Bach. It takes the opening progression from Bach's Prelude in C and lets it unfold in a beautiful and ordered way. But soon, everything starts to unravel. The music moves farther and farther away from Bach. It becomes dissonant, chaotic. The orchestra becomes increasingly frantic, and the music seems almost to tear itself apart. And it's difficult not to hear this as a kind of musical wrestling match going on. On a personal level, Pärt was wrestling artistically with the prevailing musical culture of his day, but he was also wrestling spiritually. Credo, I believe. Now, what does it mean to say, I believe, when everything is falling apart? What does it mean to say, I believe, when the culture around you is confessing that there is no God? What does it mean to say, I believe, when even your own interior life feels fractured? Credo seems to ask those kind of questions. And then, almost miraculously, as this almost 12-minute song continues, the music of Bach begins to return around the ninth minute. The piano begins to play the original melody again, high above all the chaos. The strains of the orchestra try to drown it out, but gradually the original music begins to prevail. Then the choir returns, and the music becomes hymn-like. And, at the very end, the piano sounds all the C notes, all eight of them, one after another, from the lowest note on the keyboard all the way to the highest one. And that's how it ends. It's a remarkable ending. The piece doesn't pretend that the cacophonies never happened. The dissonance was real, the struggle was real, but chaos doesn't have the last word. There's a kind of resurrection hidden within the music. Shortly after Credo premiered, Pärt entered a season in which he could no longer compose. After Credo, he was reprimanded by Soviet authorities, and he became increasingly disillusioned with the direction of his own music. For about 8 years, he wrote almost nothing and went silent, so to speak. He described himself during this time as feeling like skin that had been badly burned and in need of a skin graft. One piece of new skin at a time. I find that to be an incredibly stark image. Sometimes we imagine that the most important thing God can do for us is to make us productive. But Jesus tells us that his Father prunes us before we can become fruitful. What if there are seasons when the most important thing happening in our lives looks like, from the outside at least, like nothing is happening at all? Pärt entered a long, tomb-like silence in 1968 after writing Credo. It seemed as if nothing was happening at all. Yet in those 8 years of silence, at least two things did begin to happen. First, he discovered the ancient music of the church, in particular early Western sacred music, and medieval chant. This helped to spur him on in a search for something simpler and pure in his own music, something that could touch what he called the deepest heart of life. And secondly, during this period, the same time, something else was happening. His spiritual life was deepening. He and his wife Nora were drawn into the Christian faith and eventually into the Russian Orthodox Church. During this protracted season, his silence was not merely a compositional silence. It was a spiritual silence. He was learning to listen, and slowly, something new began to emerge. In 1976, after those 8 years of silence, at the age of 41, Pärt wrote a short piano piece called Für Alina. It's one of the shortest pieces in his entire body of work at just over 2 minutes long. Despite its brevity, it became the foundation for almost everything else that followed. It was the first piece in what became known as his tintinnabuli style. The word tintinnabuli comes from the Latin tintinnabulum, meaning a little bell. Often, if you listen carefully to Pärt's music, you can almost hear the bells. In Für Alina, there are two voices. One voice carries the melody. The other moves around the notes of a simple triad. They remain distinct, but they belong together. To me, this is one reason why the music feels so much like prayer. One voice speaks, another voice answers. Within the peace, there is movement, and there is stillness. There is sound, and there is silence. There is freedom, and there is form. What I find particularly beautiful is that Peart's strict musical rules he developed are occasionally broken even in this first instance of Tintinnabuli and Ferlina. For in several places, something happens musically that shouldn't happen at all according to his rules. For example, at the very end, when the melody ought to be diminishing to a single note, three additional notes appear, almost as though the music is suggesting that the song might continue. There's a sense that a new journey might still begin. I just love that. The whole of this piece, Ferlina, seems to convey what Peart himself had experienced. A life that it seemed to reach an ending becomes a beginning. A silence becomes a song. A failure becomes a place of grace. A death becomes the place where new life begins. Peart himself has said that the moment that this new musical language emerged was, for him and for Nora, like the big bang of creation. Furthermore, he went on to connect this second voice to the words of Jesus in John 15. Without me, you can do nothing. Nothing. That's a difficult word for me. I like to think that I can do something. I like to be productive. I like to accomplish things. I like to demonstrate my usefulness to others. But one of the deepest lessons of prayer I've acquired from listening to the music of Arvo Peart is learning to receive the truth that Jesus speaks so plainly in his farewell discourse. Without me, you can do nothing. Most Christians who have carefully listened to Jesus know that the spiritual life doesn't begin with what we do for God, but with what we receive from God. And Ferlina reminds me of this. There's also another dimension about Ferlina that I find poignant. The piece was written for a young Lithuanian woman named Lena, whose mother was a close friend of Arvo and Nora Peart. The Iron Curtain had separated mother and daughter, and Peart wrote this short piece for Lena in that context of separation. And yet, years later, listeners began telling Peart that they had played for Lena when their own children were born. Some parents even named their daughters Alina after hearing this piece. How lovely is that? Music born in a world of separation becomes linked with birth. Something that emerged from a season of death and silence becomes, for many people, the soundtrack of new life. That is Peart's story. And I think it is also, in some small way, the story of my life too. Peter Bateniff, who has written winsomely about Peart, describes those 8 years of silence as a kind of cultivation. Bateniff says that Peart's years of silence were not an absence of sound, nor were they the forsakenness of God. Rather, he considers them to be a productive silence. In time, that silence generated a sound that chimed and charmed the musical world and continues to resonate today. Bateniff's phrase, a productive silence, is one that resonates with me. I think many of us know something about unchosen silences. Seasons when we cannot fix what is broken. When we cannot force an answer. When we cannot make ourselves or others feel better. When we cannot make the music return. And so, in the silence, we wait. And sometimes we wonder whether God has gone silent too. But I think silence does not mean absence. In silence, God is doing the slow work of cultivation. There are things growing beneath the soil that we cannot yet see. Peart's story has taught me to question whether some of the silent seasons in my own life are not the wasted seasons I once thought they were. Perhaps God was, so to speak, taking the time to tune the instrument of my heart. And this brings me back to prayer. I think Peart's music has been one of the great teachers of prayer in my own life. Prayer, at least as I've come to understand it, is not primarily about saying more things to God. Often it's about becoming quiet and attentive enough to notice that God is truly present. There's an icon of John the theologian that I appreciate. John is depicted with his hand gently pressed to his mouth and the other hand pointing to the first words in the Gospel of John. It's a strange image for John, the great theologian, the one whose gospel begins with those generative words, "In the beginning was the Word." And yet here is John, with his hand over his mouth, signaling that before speaking the Word, one must first learn in silence. I agree. Before we can say something true about God, we must first learn to listen to God. Before the Christian can speak life-bearing words, the Christian must become a listening person. This is one of the great gifts parenting has given me. He has taught me not simply to enjoy silence, but to cultivate a listening posture. There's one final story about parenting that I want to tell you. In 1976, during those years when he struggled to compose, Peart was staying at a monastery in Estonia. He was sitting outdoors with his notebook lying open on his lap, trying unsuccessfully to write music. And then a little girl, about 10 years old, approached him. She asked him, curious, "What are you doing?" He told her, "I'm trying to write music. That's not turning out very well." And then she said something unforgettable. She asked him, "Have you thanked God for this failure already?" I think that is a stunning theological question. Have you thanked God for this failure already? Not, how can you fix it? Or, how can you get past it? Or even, why did God allow this? But, have you thanked God for this failure already? Peart, reflecting on that question later, observed that the most sensitive of all musical instruments is the human soul. As such, he argues that before music can be made, the instrument of the soul must be tuned. And so he says, quote, "One must start with that, not with the music." He goes on to suggest something that I find most beautiful and also challenging. He says, we should not grieve because we write little or poorly. We should grieve because we pray little and poorly and live in the wrong way. The criterion, he says, must be humility. That's a very different understanding from what most people think of a composer's vocation. This is true not only for composers. I think it's true for most of us. It's certainly true for me. The question is not simply, what have I accomplished? The deeper question is, what kind of person am I becoming? Is my soul becoming more attentive, more truthful, more humble, more compassionate, more loving, more capable of receiving grace? I think it's true that our lives, like Peart's music, are composed from the inside out. Arvo Peart has helped me to hear and to know a word that I've heard countless times in the Psalms and the Prophets, in the Epistles, and in Jesus' words in the Gospels. Namely, that God, through the Spirit, is transforming me and you too from the inside out. Sometimes quietly, often patiently, but always persistently and faithfully. I've heard this word often, but sometimes it takes another voice, another tune, for me to listen. And Peart has been that voice and provided the music to help tune my heart. That's why Arvo Peart is one of my favorite things. I appreciate Peart and his music, not just because I admire his story and the sound of his music. I do, of course. I think they're beautiful. But beauty isn't the deepest reason. The deep reason is that Peart, through his life and music, has given me a way of understanding something I've encountered again and again in my own life. God can bring something beautiful and graceful out of silence. God can work in me when I despair that nothing is happening. God can take seasons of failure and disillusionment and use them to teach me humility and dependence upon Him. God can take what feels like death, and in ways I could never have predicted, bring out new life. And most importantly, Peart has helped me to learn something about prayer. That prayer is not simply me speaking to God. Mostly, it's about me becoming quiet enough to hear God. There's one more dimension of Peart's music that I want to mention. It's something I wrote about in a recent article for The Adventurer on the theme of bright sadness or joyful sorrow. His music has helped me understand something the Orthodox Christian tradition calls karmalupe, a Greek word that combines two other Greek words, joy, karma, and sorrow, lupe. A It's a word that I found helpful to understand life for me and for others, especially since none of us lives lives of pure joy, and none of us lives lives of pure sorrow either. Our lives are almost always some strange intermingling of the two. Our lives are, as they say, bittersweet. We rejoice, and we grieve. We celebrate births, and we bury people we love. We experience forgiveness, and we carry regrets. We're grateful for what has been given to us, even while we mourn what's been taken away. This Christian truth does not require us to choose between joy and sorrow. It reminds us that somehow they can both inhabit the same heart. Paul writes in Romans 5 that we rejoice even in our sufferings because suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope. And hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit. Paul doesn't deny sorrow. Rather, he points to something deeper and more mysterious. That sorrow itself can become a place where God's love can take root. I think this is why Peart's music resonates so deeply with people who are suffering. There are stories of people who are dying who want to hear almost nothing else but Peart's music. I think I understand why. Peart doesn't give us cheap happiness. He doesn't tell us that sorrow isn't real. He lets sorrow be sorrow. But above and beneath the sorrow, almost imperceptibly, there's another voice, a quiet voice, a voice that whispers, beauty is still here. Grace is still here. Love is still here. God is still here. And mysteriously, that still small voice is usually enough. So, in conclusion, I want to say that that young man, I want to return to that story to 1991. That young fellow was walking around Regent's bookstore. The one who was overwhelmed and underprepared, the one who was newly married, the one who was ill-equipped to engage theological studies, the one who looked at all the brilliant books surrounding him and felt lacking. And then this music began to play. A violin, a piano, a little space between them, a phrase, an answer, a relationship, even in the silence. I didn't know it then, but that music would become a companion soundtrack for me for decades. It's accompanied me through joy and sorrow, through beginnings and endings, through moments when I felt strong and moments when I felt weak. That's what I hear when I listen to Spiegel im Spiegel. I hear not merely a beautiful piece of music, I experience it as a window, a kind of icon, a musical icon. It doesn't explain God. Does not tell me what God is doing, simply creates a space in which I might become attentive to God. And I think that is what prayer ultimately is. It's not figuring everything out about life and God. It's not about finding the right words. It's not about making the right argument, but becoming still, listening, waiting, and discovering that in the silence, we're not alone. There's a long-standing Christian conviction that God creates out of nothing. Ex nihilo. Out of nothing, God creates. Peart himself came through a period in life when he felt he had almost nothing left to say or write, and somehow out of that silence a new music was born. To be perfectly honest, during the last few years, I've experienced something similar. Maybe some of you have too. Can you recall seasons, or maybe you're even going through one right now, when in your own life, like mine, you feel much barrenness and silence? Are there failures you'd rather forget? Are there losses you still carry? Are there wounds that have not yet fully healed? Are there things you've tried to craft or repair that simply haven't turned out as you hoped? And maybe, like me, you've been tempted to think that these seasons are a waste of time. But what if they're not? What if God is doing something in the apparent wasteland of silence? What if the silence is not the absence of music, but the preparation for a new song? What if above the silence the Spirit of God is hovering? What if the invitation to prayer is simply this: be still long enough to listen? because, possibly, as Peart's music has taught me, silence is not an empty thing, but a pregnant fullness. It's full. Full of God. Full of hope. Full of love. Full of the slow workings of God's grace. And if we listen long enough, we may discover that God has been preparing us for a new song we could not yet hear until the noise around and within is silenced. So there you have it, Arvo Peart and his music. It's one of my favorite things.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.